I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. When Turing Pharmaceuticals raised the price of a 60-year-old drug, Daraprim, from $13.50 a pill to $750 a pill, people were flabbergasted, horrified, infuriated. What could explain a 5,000% price hike of an established drug overnight? The company lowered the cost because of all the bad press, but many doctors and consumer advocates and politicians say there are plenty of other examples of overpriced drugs. Now, some argue that the government needs to regulate drug costs, while others say regulation would stifle drug development. In this hour of Radio Times, why are prescription drugs so expensive and what can be done about it? We start things off with Julie Rovner, senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. And Julie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
Is Turing an outlier, or does it reveal something about how we price drugs in this country?
Well, I think, you know, since I started covering this 20-some years ago, the drug industry has kind of divided itself up. It used to be you had the big drug companies, they researched drugs, and they sold them. And basically, they used the prices of the drugs that succeeded to fund their research. That's not exactly how the drug industry is anymore. You still have some of those traditional companies. But now you have companies that simply make generics, and they make their money by buying, you know, by figuring out how to copy drugs that have come off patent and selling those. And then you have these companies, as you mentioned, like Turing and Valeant, that go out and they buy established drugs that are no longer on patent but may not have a big enough patient base to make it worth doing a generic. So there's still a monopoly even though their patent's expired. And they'll buy those drugs, and, you know, in order to make profit, to make show profits for their stakeholders, these are for-profit companies, they'll just raise the prices. And we've seen a lot of that. So we've seen prices going up on generic drugs. We've seen prices going up because they're bought by companies that simply want to raise the price. And we've also seen prices going up in general on more traditional drugs from more traditional companies that they say they're using to offset the increasing cost of research to develop yet more drugs.
Does this tell us something about the business climate or an aging population? I mean, digging even deeper, why the increases? And I understand the buying and, I guess, and selling of companies. But when you look at Canada, you look at some of the other countries in Europe, they don't pay nearly what we pay in this country for drugs.
No, the U.S. is the only industrialized nation that does not somehow regulate the price of drugs. And it's interesting that a lot of the proposals out in sort of the political winds right now have to do with capping what consumers pay. But nobody is actually suggesting that drug prices be officially regulated. There's kind of still a lot of nibbling around the edges. I think one of the reasons we're seeing this, though, right now, is that consumers are, for the first time, picking up a larger and larger share of their drug costs. What you paid for a prescription drug used to be just folded into what you paid for your insurance. It would be $10 or $15 or possibly at the high end $50 a prescription. Now, more and more insurance companies, because drugs are so expensive, are asking consumers to pay what's called co-insurance, a percentage of how much the drug costs. So if the drug costs $1,000 and you're paying 20%, that's painful. But if a drug suddenly goes up to $5,000 and you're paying 20%, the consumers are feeling that. And with much higher deductibles and the rise of coinsurance in recent years, consumers are feeling it more and more.
Well, who can pay? I mean, even if you have a really good salary, who can pay, you know, $2,000 a month or $1,000 for a pill?
Well, that's exactly the point. And there are, and there have been for quite a long time, programs that help consumers who take very expensive medications afford that medication. But they're not for everyone. You have to meet income limits. Sometimes they're hard to find. Sometimes they're full. Sometimes, you know, they're giving out away as much of the drug as they can. So, yeah, it's an increasing problem, so much so that particularly in cancer drugs, that cancer doctors are starting to complain.
And what about the Affordable Care Act? Has it done anything to address this issue?
It really didn't. The Affordable Care Act, one of the things about the Affordable Care Act is that there was a deal reached basically between its sponsors and pharma, the pharmaceutical industry lobbying group here in Washington. And so they basically backed off of a lot of those in an attempt to try and sort of do other things first. Now you see Hillary Clinton, for instance, and Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side and Martin O'Malley coming back and saying, maybe we do need a little bit more regulation than we, you know, agreed not to have in the Affordable Care Act.
if not regulated, I mean, is this up for negotiation? Are there any calls to sort of revisit this issue to try to get these costs under control somehow?
Well, certainly there is a call to allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices. Medicare didn't used to cover outpatient prescription drugs. That was added in 2003 under a then Republican Congress and signed by a Republican president. And there, that law included a ban on Medicare negotiating the price of drugs. And interestingly, Tommy Thompson, who was the Secretary of Health and Human Services at the time, former governor of Wisconsin, on his way out of his farewell press conference, someone asked him, what do you most regret? And he said, he turned back and went back to the podium and said, not allowing negotiation for Medicare prescription drug prices.
I mean, that seems like a good place to start, doesn't it?
Well, you know, that's certainly been the argument. Obviously, older people take more drugs, so it's an enormous market. The drug program didn't cost a lot in its first few years, primarily because there was so much of a movement to generic drugs. But now we're seeing, you know, as we mentioned earlier, generic drug prices also going up, plus many new medications that are much more expensive. And I think there's more pressure than there has been about letting Medicare negotiate prices.
And Julie, so make sure our listeners and I are clear about this. In the United States, drug companies can set their own prices. Is that correct?
That's correct. With some limitations. Medicaid, for instance, only pays certain amounts. The Department of Veterans Affairs actually has a drug formulary. They don't offer every drug, and they negotiate prices. So there is price negotiation. Insurers, what are called pharmaceutical benefits managers, negotiate prices. But in general, the price is set by the drug company itself.
You mentioned Hillary Clinton rolling out, probably in response to some of these articles that have talked about such dramatic increases overnight, but she's rolled out some ideas about how to address the high price of pharmaceuticals. What has she come up with?
Well, most of these are ideas that have been around for quite a while but haven't really gone anywhere. As we talked about, allowing Medicare to negotiate, allowing Medicare to pay Medicaid prices, which are much lower, things about eliminating tax breaks for drug promotion and advertising. That one's been around since the 1990s. Also, she would impose out-of-pocket limits for consumers on how much they have to pay for drugs. Several states have already done this. The problem with that, of course, is that it doesn't lower prices. It simply passes on the higher prices to someone other than the consumer.
I've read that there are, there's the price that's asked for, and then there's the price that paid. Let's say a pill costs $250, the consumer pays $25. Who picks up the rest?
Well, generally, the insurance company, if that person is insured, picks up the rest. And that's why insurance companies, try to, and these middlemen, the prescription benefits managers, try to negotiate. Sometimes they'll negotiate a lower price with a company if there are lots of other drugs. So they'll say, we'll give you all of our business, but just for this drug, and the other drugs aren't on what's called the formulary. You'd have to pay more for those drugs. So they'll get a lower price for some of the preferred drugs. That's what preferred drugs refers to when you're actually, as the consumer, looking at how much you have to pay out of pocket. So there is some negotiating going on. But that only works if there are multiple drugs in that category. It works for statins, for cholesterol. It works for antidepressants, where there are 5, 10, sometimes 25 drugs in a class. It doesn't work for some of these drugs we've been hearing about, where there's only one drug to treat a particular disease.
You've mentioned Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley. Have they come up with plans similar to Hillary Clinton's?
Yes, Bernie Sanders actually has been, we haven't mentioned this either, the idea of allowing people to buy their drugs from overseas, mostly from Canada. Bernie Sanders has been a champion of that since he was in the House. He rather famously took breast cancer patients on bus trips to Canada, just over the border from Vermont, to get their breast cancer medication, which was, a fraction of the cost that they were paying in the U.S. So he's always been sort of a major supporter of that. And drug costs, bringing down the high cost of drugs has been sort of one of his issues for as long as he's been in Congress.
And how about Republicans? Have any of them stepped into this fray, if I can call it that?
Not really. There are a few Republicans who are tiptoeing around having a health plan in general, something that they would like to replace the Affordable Care Act. But they've been mostly pretty quiet about what to do about drug prices.
We'll be talking with a doctor a little bit later on in the show, but some physicians have organized and complained about some of these drug prices, including at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, saying we're not going to prescribe this drug because it's just too gosh darn expensive.
That's right. I mean, what I think a lot of doctors are trying to do is look at value. It's one thing to have, you know, the big argument over the last year had been about Sovaldi, which was a breakthrough drug that actually cures hepatitis C, but it costs $84,000 for the course of treatment, which is a lot of money when you have, you know, several million people with hepatitis C. But that at least, you know, people don't say that that's not a value. Before that, you know, it would be very expensive to care for these patients in any case. So there was going to be a lot of spending. That's a drug that clearly produces value. The question is, you know, what happens when you just get more and more and more drugs that are more and more and more expensive, and you're starting to see, as you mentioned, cancer doctors start looking at, you know, well, do I really want to prescribe this drug that's only going to extend life for a matter of days or possibly weeks? How much of a value is that if it causes bankruptcy?
I mean, it seems to me that would be a pretty interesting debate if it becomes a very public debate in this country.
Oh, it already is. And it's interesting to see sort of doctors leading the way, learning more about how much drugs cost, because generally, you know, until recently, both doctors and patients were shielded from the cost of drugs. They write the prescription with no idea how much it costs. The patient would go get it and pay their copay, and they have no idea how much it costs. So at least we're getting a debate because we're actually seeing for the first time how much these drugs do cost.
I'm wondering also about the issue of compliance. We've done a number of shows on Radio Times, physicians concerned that they might prescribe a drug for a patient, but then the patient doesn't take it as it is supposed to be taken. But if something is costing hundreds of dollars, is the issue of compliance an important one?
Absolutely. And I'm sure I've certainly stood in line at the drugstore to pick up a prescription and seen someone ahead of me, you know, get their prescription and realize that they're supposed to pay several hundred dollars and just give it back or go back and have to call the insurance company. Or, you know, it is a very common thing now that, you know, instead of handing over the prescription and asking for $10 or $20, they hand over the prescription and ask for several hundred, sometimes more than 1,000.
We're almost out of time here. As you said, Julie, you've been covering this for 25 years. Are we reaching some kind of critical juncture on the issue of pricing for pharmaceuticals?
I think, as I mentioned, I think the idea that people are suddenly for the first time becoming aware of how much it costs, I think that may push something in a way that it hasn't been pushed before. But the drug industry will argue that, you know, that if you don't let them earn a return, they're not going to have the money for research to find the next breakthrough, the next cure for hepatitis C, the cure for AIDS, the cure for cancer. I think the debate will continue. Don't know whether I would say we've reached a tipping point.
Well, we have a representative from pharma waiting in the wings. In the meantime, Julie Rovner, as always, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And she's senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And in this hour of Radio Times, we're talking about the price, the high price of pharmaceuticals in the United States. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. And as I said, we have a guest from pharma waiting in the wings. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us, WHYY Radio Times. Tell us what you think. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Let me just do a quick recap. Yesterday, the New York Times published a front-page story about Valeant Pharmaceuticals quadrupling the price of cupramine overnight for the treatment of Wilson disease. A couple of weeks ago, the Times printed a story about Turing Pharmaceuticals raising the price of a 60-year-old drug, Daraprim, from $13 a pill to $7.50 a pill. And because of all the outcry, they have reduced that price from $7.50 a pill. In this hour of Radio Times, we're talking about the price of drugs, why some are so expensive, what, if anything, can be done about it. And joining us now is Lori Riley, Executive Vice President for Policy and Research at the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. That's PhRMA. And Lori Riley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let me ask you about these two stories that have gotten so much press, one about Valeant Pharmaceuticals, the first one, Turing Pharmaceuticals. Is there any justification for such a dramatic increase in the price of these drugs?
Well, thanks for asking me the question. Both Turing Pharmaceuticals and Valeant Pharmaceuticals are actually not members of the trade association that I represent. I think the model that both of these companies have is actually very different than the innovative pharmaceutical companies that I represent. in the sense that, they typically don't do significant research and development like many biopharmaceuticals companies. On average, our companies invest well over 20% of their revenue back into research and development. The model that both Turing and Valiant have is very different from that. And so, you know, we as an association, I certainly don't stand by either the actions or the comments that the CEO from Turing Pharmaceuticals has made. Again, I think oftentimes what is being conflated is the behavior of those two companies compared to research-based pharmaceutical industry that does spend significant resources, the most of any other business in the country in research and development.
Well, let me just pick up on that, and thank you for that clarification there. But it is true in the United States, Americans pay a lot more for their pharmaceutical drugs than Canadians do, than other people living in, you know, wealthy westernized countries, really are equivalent in many ways. What explains that?
Well, I think, you know, often the times the comparisons that we see are problematic in a few ways. Number one, they will often take a list price in the U.S. that, quite honestly, no one really pays, and they will compare that to a price that has been set oftentimes by a government in another country as the comparison. However, when you look at, and I'll just take Medicare Part D as an example, this is the program that seniors in this country utilize to access prescription drugs, and you compare, even when you take into account the premiums that seniors pay on a monthly basis coupled with the co-payments that seniors pay, and you compare those costs compared to, for example, many of the Canadian pharmacies, what you'll find is Americans actually fare better. Now, of course, there are instances where prices in other countries may be lower. Oftentimes, that's because those countries have made a decision to control the prices of their products, but in exchange for those controls, they also tend to limit access to oftentimes very important new advancements. And just using the UK as one example, in 2013, that government in UK decided not to provide access to any cancer medicines that had been approved there that year. The U.S., we have a different system where medicines are come to market, and by and large, patients get access to them. So there is often a trade-off that is often left out of the debate between access and a country's willingness to, quote, control the prices. The U.S., again, we have a very different system where we have powerful negotiators, insurance companies, and pharmacy benefit managers that engage every day negotiating with companies to drive good bargains. And those bargains do lead to very good deals for American patients. Again, unfortunately, this debate, we've focused a lot on list prices and very little, unfortunately, on prices when you take into account rebates and significant discounts that companies actually provide.
But there still are plenty of examples and anecdotes and, you know, frankly, people I know that are paying a lot more for their pharmaceuticals. They're paying, you know, sometimes hundreds of dollars when they go to the drugstore. What can justify that?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and I think part of the problem that we see in terms of where our insurance model in this country is headed is that we ask patients to bear a much higher percentage out of pocket for prescription drugs compared to virtually any other healthcare service. So on average, patients are asked to pay about 20% of the cost of their medicine as compared to if an individual went into the hospital where they're asked to pay about 5% out of pocket. So patients that rely on prescription medicines compared to needing a surgical procedure, for example, are feeling it a lot more than those patients that are going to the hospital or visiting their physician. And so, yes, patients do feel the pinch more when it comes to pharmaceuticals, in part because of how the insurance design is set up in this country. That's, you know, in part based on how care was delivered many, many years ago. But moving forward, more and more care is being delivered by taking a medicine. And, you know, unfortunately, many patients are in essence penalized if their condition is one that could be treated with a medication as opposed to needing some sort of surgical intervention, hospital stay, et cetera, in terms of how much they're asked to bear the cost of it.
Do you think Medicare, and this is a law passed by Congress, but do you think Medicare should be allowed to negotiate over drug prices? Obviously, Medicare using a lot of the drugs that we're probably talking about.
Well, you know, there is, you know, unfortunately, almost an old wives' tale that has brewed that there is not negotiation in Medicare. And the reality is the Medicare Part D program works unlike almost any program in Medicare, in the fact that private sector negotiators, companies like Express Scripts that are pharmacy benefit managers, negotiate with pharmaceutical manufacturers on behalf of the government. And these pharmacy benefit managers often are negotiating on behalf of millions, and in the case of Express Scripts, 90 million patients that they negotiate on behalf of. They have tremendous leverage, so much leverage, in fact, that when Medicare, when that law was passed, there was a presumption about how much that program would cost the government over 10 years. They were off by a factor of almost 50%. The program is actually 50% less in terms of what it costs the government compared to what we thought it was going to cost, in part based on the significant negotiating leverage that, that PBMs have brought to the table. So we think that's a program that honestly is a model in terms of how programs can work to drive bargains for patients. Consumers are very happy with that program. It has over a 90% approval rating, and it's working for patients and it's working for taxpayers.
Every time I turn my television on, frankly, I see ads for pharmaceutical drugs. I mean, they are everywhere. Obviously, all the lovely pictures about how this drug can help you, and then all the disclaimers at the very end that scare you to death. But nonetheless, how much, I mean, that is driving demand for a lot of drugs as well. And I mean, advertising, you're allowed to advertise in this country. But right. How much does pharma, how much do your membership, how much do they pay out of their profits to sell these drugs?
That's a great question. About $3 billion, a little over $3 billion, is what is typically spent on advertising medicines. You know, the presumption I think that many people have is they see an ad and they run into the doctor and they walk away with it. You know, the reality is often much different. We know that direct-to-consumer advertising for many conditions causes people to think about, maybe I have that condition. Maybe those symptoms that I'm hearing about are something I should ask my doctor about. But once that patient walks into a doctor's office, many different things happen. First of all, there's a conversation, which is an important conversation for patients to have with their doctor about what might be causing the symptoms that they're having. There's no guarantee that that patient walks out with that prescription. In fact, you know, 85%, we're approaching almost 90% of all prescriptions in the United States are actually for generic medicines, and those tend not to be advertised. So the positive benefit of direct-to-consumer advertising is that it prompts important conversations that patients can have with their physician. We know over the years that, you know, increased diagnosis for things like depression have happened as a result of advertising that we've seen because patients have realized, hey, that sounds like a symptom I have. I should have a conversation with my doctor. Doesn't necessarily mean that it leads to a prescription and certainly doesn't necessarily lead to a prescription for the medicine that they that may have prompted their entry into the doctor's office.
But plenty of doctors will tell you that they feel a lot of pressure from their patients for a very specific drug that they saw on television.
And that may be the case. I would say, again, that you know, about close to 90% of all medicines are generic, and that's in part because there's strong incentives in the system for patients to use a generic medicine when one is available. They often are less expensive in terms of copays patients are asked, and there's often incentives for physicians to ensure that they prescribe generic medicines when available. But there are times when a patient does, in fact, need a brand medicine. It may be a condition that, you know, the generic medicine may not work for them. And so it's good to have options available.
One of the arguments, and we have to say goodbye to you in just a couple of minutes.
Sure.
One of the arguments I've heard is that perhaps drugs, pharmaceuticals should have price controls like utilities, like electricity and water, because it's a necessity. It's not a cell phone, although sometimes that does feel like a necessity. But this is a necessity. This is about people's health, and perhaps it's time to bring some more regulation to pharmaceutical drugs.
Well, you know, and obviously we hear those arguments a lot. I would say the concern that we have with those is what incentive does it create for a company to take the kind of risk that companies often face? Unfortunately, 90% of what pharmaceutical companies take to the FDA ultimately fails in the clinical trial process. So we fail much more than we succeed. when we succeed, there has to be an incentive for that success. And today we're facing significant healthcare crises. Just take Alzheimer's for an example. By 2015, our country will be spending $1 trillion to treat Alzheimer's if we do nothing to slow the progression and hopefully one day cure that disease. If we take the incentives away from companies, and we have companies in our membership that have been working on Alzheimer's for 30 years to no avail. In fact, over 115 different products have been attempted to get to market, and today we only have 4 medicines on the market for Alzheimer's. If we take away the incentives for companies to do that investment of research that sometimes spans multiple decades, then I worry that the kind of innovation that we need for the future, for our future healthcare cost concerns, we've significantly diminished, if not taken away, incentives to do that. I think what we'll be left with is incentives for companies to do research in areas where the science isn't as risky. But quite honestly, the areas where we need innovation and we need new science are often in the riskiest conditions in terms of treating them. They're for the neurological conditions. Yeah, I lost a mother to ALS, and theirs is a condition where today we really don't have effective treatments to do anything to delay the progress of that disease or hopefully one day cure it. But as a society, we're spending significant amounts of money to treat patients with Alzheimer's, with ALS, because they end up in institutional care. I think most people, if given a choice, would rather spend their resources on a medicine that delays those conditions or keeps them out of the nursing home, as opposed to spending the same resources to send patients into the nursing home or face a very, untimely death. So, you know, yes, there are trade-offs in the system, but I think we have to have an honest conversation about the cost that we're bearing today and what we're expected to bear in the future for conditions and what could happen if we allow science to progress, particularly for some of these very devastating conditions.
Well, Laurie Riley, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
She's the Executive Vice President for Policy and Research at the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, otherwise known as PhRMA. And joining us now is Peter Bach. He's a physician and director of the Center for Health Policy and Outcomes at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Peter Bach, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to ask you what I asked our other two guests. What do you think are the price drivers for pharmaceuticals in this country?
Well, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Basically, we have a system where we have no downward pressure on prices. Companies can set prices at any level they wish. And there's really very few mechanisms in place to either have the competition that Ms. Riley was alluding to or have prices travel in any way related to the value of drugs in terms of what they do either for patients or what they represent in terms of science. And Ms. Riley is correct in the sense that there is a marketplace for drugs, but many of the things she asserted were not accurate.
For instance, it is,
as you asked her, the case that prices that are faced by patients and insurers are much higher in the U.S. than they are in other countries. There are various things, rebates and deals, but at the end of the day, patients in this country are facing much higher costs, and it is because the pharmaceutical industry can set prices wherever they want. And Valiant Pharmaceuticals, Turing Pharmaceuticals, are just rarefied versions of pricing behavior that we see across the industry. It is, of course, desirable to pretend they're outliers, but Pfizer, one of the world's largest drug companies, a key innovative company in the pharmaceutical space, raised the price of 133 drugs last year. So that's not just Valiant or Turing doing that. That's a major pharmaceutical company doing that. Biogen, there was a big piece in the Wall Street Journal yesterday from Joe Walker about Biogen raising the price of a drug, a branded drug, 21 times over the last several years. So this is happening all over. Novartis has raised the price of Gleevec, an important drug for leukemia, by almost threefold since it was first launched in the U.S. in 2001. During that time, the price of the same drug and same pill in France has been flat, unchanged, not raised. So there are no downward pressures on prices. There is no meaningful competition in many of the specialty areas where these high-priced drugs exist. And consumers and patients are losing access because of it, because out-of-pocket costs travel with the cost of the drug. So a higher-priced drug, as we saw in the New York Times yesterday, as the price is raised by Valiant, the out-of-pocket goes up to the point where the patient in that story's wife has now had to take a second job to pay for the profits of Valiant.
Well, and just picking up on several things that you said in about a minute or so before our break here, what you're saying is that, yes, there might be discounts, there might be rebates, but that if something costs $1,000 a pill, somebody or something in the system is going to pay for that. Even if I pay $50, someone else is going to pick up that $950.
Right. And just to be clear, we're talking about essentially what we would usually think about as customers is the retail price. And it's true that maybe the car you buy, the company selling it has to pay various middlemen and negotiate discounts. But at the end of the day, you're writing a check for the amount that car costs. And so we've been tracking on the Sloan Kettering website for back to the beginning of Medicare, the cost to Medicare patients and the Medicare program that we all pay for with tax dollars, the cost of each cancer drug for a month of treatment. It's gone up 100-fold since 1965 after adjusting for inflation. So all those discounts and rebates that were mentioned, we don't have to look at any of those. We know how much it costs Medicare, taxpayers, and patients, and that's the price rise during a period in time where the average discount compared to Europe is about 40%.
And that's Peter Bach. He's a physician, also director of the Center for Health Policy and Outcomes at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about the high price of drugs, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email. I see some already there, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Peter Bach about the price, the high price of drugs in the United States. And we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Peter, you wrote something in the New York Times back in January, actually earlier this year. You said companies are taking advantage of a mix of laws that force insurers to include essentially all expensive drugs in their policies and a philosophy that demands that every new healthcare product be available to everyone, no matter how little it helps or how much it costs. Costs, anything else, and we're talking about death panels. Expand on that for us, would you?
Yes, well, thank you. The question, when you have a functioning market that achieves appropriate prices, one of the key features of that is the person who is buying the product has an option to walk away. And it's only through that kind of negotiation that you get appropriate pricing. But most laws point at, for example, the Medicare program and say, you know, every drug in cancer, every drug for neurologic conditions, every drug for depression, every drug for seizures, Medicare, you have to have those drugs available to Medicare beneficiaries. And there's nothing wrong with the principle of this idea. In fact, it's a really good idea, but the pharmaceutical industry has been able to then leverage that to put in unconstrained rises in prices because Medicare and therefore taxpayers and the elderly must buy those drugs. And in cancer, there's a provision that Medicare must allow beneficiaries to have every cancer drug for every indication approved by the Food and Drug Administration, as well as that recommended by doctors. Again, a very good idea for the benefit of cancer patients, but easy to take advantage of, and it's why we see 100-fold price inflation in cancer drugs over the last 50 years. There is no downward pressure on prices, but also the industry feels no compunction to raise prices faster than any other area in healthcare. And Ms. Riley mentioned the area of depression, a very challenging disease area.
Sure.
She talked about new therapies. She left out that she talked about Part D, the oral prescription drug benefit in Medicare, achieving savings. She left out the fact that Medicare is required by law to cover every drug for depression for all of its beneficiaries. Again, good for patients, but it means that pharmaceutical companies can charge whatever they want. To have a functioning market, the buyer must be able to say no. In Germany, we see about a 40% discount on cancer drugs. 97% of drugs available in Germany are available here. They have a few we don't. We have a few they don't. The average patient pays $13 out of pocket compared to thousands of dollars out of pocket here because of this price difference.
Well, let me pick on what you said, because part of this article was also looking at Europe and the fact that a number of countries have governments that basically negotiate and say no, as you said, say no to some of these drug companies over things like price. Is that something we could import to the United States?
I don't think so, actually. The key learning there is that the prices that we face here are a product of the marketplace we have allowed to foster in the U.S. When there is any sort of government effort to marshal societal resources efficiently in these other countries, pharmaceutical companies provide huge discounts. And one of the examples I gave in that article, my hospital rejected Sanofi's drug Zaltrap, a drug for colon cancer, because it costs too much. And we wrote an op-ed about that as well. And the company gave us, not only us, but the entire country, a 50% discount on the drug once we wrote that op-ed. The gentleman at Turing Pharmaceuticals has now said he is going to discount that drug Daraprim that he just hiked the price of because of bad publicity. And so these prices are not a natural outgrowth of research and development. They are a product of a market that can't say we want a different price and that has no authority. But saying no and competition will only get us so far. What we should do is we should try and pay for drugs based on the value they bring to patients and in terms of what they bring in terms of scientific progress.
And by value, you mean if they work or not?
If they work. I mean, in simple terms, a drug that works better should have a higher price than a drug that works less well. And by doing that, we can get the innovation we want, exactly what Ms. Riley was talking about. We can have research aimed at making patients better off, and we can be much more thoughtful about getting pricing right so that when patients have a drug they need, which is priced appropriately based on its value, the insurance system and Medicare should acknowledge that and not tack on large copayments. The reason we have high copayments is because we have out-of-control pricing that bears no relationship to the benefits of treatments.
Well, we've got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Let me get Lisa from Broomall to join us. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Great topic.
Thank you.
I have multiple sclerosis, and the medication that I'm on is injectable at home every other day. I had to have my insurance switched through my husband's work. Because of that, I have to receive it through the mail, and I don't see how much it costs. But a couple years ago, it used to cost $5,000-$6,000 a month. Now, how sustainable is that? And what happens if the insurance company suddenly decides that they're not going to, eat the cost anymore? It's a very expensive drug.
Sure, or put some kind of limit on it. Peter Bach, do you have any thoughts for Lisa?
Well, no, thank you for your question, Lisa. This is a problem and a challenge, and of course, I hope you're doing well with your condition. But this issue of shifting costs to patients is a consequence of very high prices of drugs. And so insurers are sort of indiscriminately trying to keep their products appropriately priced to sell in a marketplace so that when there are high-cost drugs like this, they force the patients who, through just oftentimes bad luck, have hard-to-treat conditions. And this is why we need a system that finds prices that are appropriate. And when those prices are appropriate, we don't put patients in a position where they have to pay huge out-of-pocket sums for them.
But can we, under a system like that, can drug companies do the kind of research, as Lori Riley was saying earlier, sometimes this takes years and a huge investment, the kind of research needed to develop the drugs to help people like Lisa at an affordable price.
Yes, 100%. In fact, we'd be much better off if you think, if you believe how markets are supposed to work, if we paid more for drugs that worked better, then companies that were better at innovation and were better at creating really important drugs would prosper. And ones that weren't, that were tagging along, would not. And that's how markets are supposed to work. What we have now in many of these areas is a company will have a great new breakthrough drug, and then there'll be four companies making essentially similar copies and actually charging even more for those copies. So we have a lot of sort of laggards along with innovative companies with no discrimination between them. And, you know, this issue about innovation, it couldn't be more important. But the truth is that the rate of applications going through the Food and Drug Administration is up. The number, the way to get approved in terms of the scientific bars are down. The rate of approvals of what's called new drug applications has gone from about mid-50% to north of 90% in the last 7 years.
Wow.
And even the rate, the time between an important scientific discovery, like an alteration that causes cancer, and a drug that effectively targets it, has shrunk from decades to a handful of years. So that's all great news for science, but it also means that it is getting easier to innovate. That's great news for patients, but we are not seeing that benefit in terms of prices.
And
we're seeing the opposite.
And that's Peter Bach. He's a physician, also director of the Center for Health Policy and Outcomes at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. The third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times talking about why we pay what we do for drugs. And let me give out the phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499. Peter, we have a tweet from Karen who says, I'm a young doc frustrated by high basic medical costs and a shortage of basic supplies like saline. Rx companies don't exist. I mean, we were talking about very expensive and fancy drugs, but saline, that's pretty basic, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and I don't know about that specific shortage, but we do on the other end clearly have a broken market for, you know, inexpensive products and old generic drugs, and we have seen both, you know, shocking price hikes on drugs that are life-saving that we've had for decades and decades, like we've seen with Turing and Valiant, and we've seen important shortages of things like, I guess in this example, saline, but we've seen it with many other drugs. This is all evidence that the marketplace that we would like to work is not working.
Let me get Adam, looks like from Center City, Philadelphia. Hi, Adam. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
I've enjoyed some of the comments from the guests, but I do have a question about the suggestion of varying drug prices based on their relative efficacy. I think a problem with that is that there are a number of drugs that do essentially the same thing. These are often criticized as Me Too drugs, but they present a different mix of side effects for different classes of patients. So a company might invent a drug that is not a huge advance forward in terms of overall population health, but is an advance for the particular class of patients that's going to be marketed to. I'm wondering how your proposal could deal with that.
Adam, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Interesting question. Peter Bach?
Yeah, Adam, that's a great question. And I think the simple answer is that a follow-on drug or a drug that is similar to another compound might get a very similar price. And so that is exactly the kind of iterative innovation that I think we'd all like to see. And we don't see right now those kinds of drugs getting similar prices. We see companies charging even higher prices, and in many cases, then the original price of the original drug gets raised to meet them. So absolutely, the idea is not to say, okay, the innovator compound gets a price and everybody else is ignored. We're all better off if we have more drugs that work with the small differences you're talking about, and if they bring similar value to patients, they should garner a similar price.
Laurie Riley said something earlier, which is in our medical system, we are more and more reliant on pharmaceuticals. Do you agree with that, Peter Bach?
Well, I think we're seeing a different mix. We are hopefully less reliant on the hospital, more reliant on outpatient care. She is right that the fastest growing sector of spending in healthcare is prescription drugs and specialty drugs specifically. But I don't know that the number of prescriptions per person has risen or any other metric that you would use to support that claim.
Let me see what Ed from Drexel Hill has to say. Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I just, I don't know where the research money comes from. Does it come from our tax money, from our government? And secondly, what happens, I know the patents have run out, and a lot of, I mean, they've stopped generic medicine, especially like in India and stuff. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying, so where does, I mean, if a company is investing millions, maybe even more in a drug, where does the money come from, Peter Bach?
Yes, it's coming partly from our tax money, from the government.
Can you answer that, Peter?
Sure. There's no question there's been a huge social and societal investment in the development of not only new drugs, but also in the training of doctors and the building of hospitals. We've all invested in this healthcare delivery system. We do it through tax dollars that go to the National Institutes of Health. We and our patients do it by volunteering their time for clinical research studies. And on the back end, when companies make successful products, we pay for them again with our tax dollars, with our insurance premiums, with our state taxes to Medicaid program, and out of pocket. So that's how the money flows. It isn't necessarily a problem. The pharmaceutical industry is one of the most important innovative engines in this country, and it's absolutely critical to improving societal health. No one questions that. Where the break in the system is in the unconstrained increases in prices and the complete dissociation of prices from the value of the products. We want new drugs. We want to make our patients better. We want to lower the death rate from cancer. We want to prolong the lives of patients with neurologic declines from Alzheimer's and things like that. What we can't afford is to have rapid rises in prices of drugs that cover huge populations and cripple budgets of Medicaid programs, the Veterans Administration, and sort of take all of the savings of many patients in the Medicare program.
And a final question to you, Peter Bach. Should there be more transparency when it comes to pricing? I know a number of states have called for more ability to, I guess, look inside a company to try to figure out why they're charging what they do.
I think the first step is to come up with an approach for achieving prices that marry to what society's goals are, and those are improvements in health and improvements in wellness and, as I mentioned, scientific breakthroughs as well, and to have prices that preserve the budgets of important programs that do other things, like Medicaid programs. And I think transparency is always good to that end, and I think particularly in the generic space, companies like Valiant and Turing, that the price hikes they have imposed don't marry to any reasonable business model. And so I think that those have merits. But I would think that one of the goals here is to let the industry function as best as it can on its own, but pay it back, allow it to profit for the successes we care about most, and connect those to patients so that patients aren't priced out of drugs that will help them.
Well, on that note, Peter Bach, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. He's a physician, also director of the Center for Health Policy and Outcomes at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can learn much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.